I'm here with Dr. Richard Bernstein. Dr. Bernstein was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes in something like 1946. I think he's probably the only person in the world that can say that he saved his own life by figuring out what to eat. He's been a pioneer in terms of diabetes, and I don't think I'm exaggerating by saying this, that I think Dr. Bernstein deserves to win a Nobel Prize for his work in diabetes, but it's unfortunately been completely ignored by the mainstream establishment because so many things are profoundly wrong with a lot of research. And Dr. Bernstein figured out essentially that a lot of what today we call the paleo diet, except paleo has fruit, but he figured it out in 1970 by testing his blood glucose. So Dr. Bernstein, thanks for your work over the years, and thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you, Adrian.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about your story?
I was a type 1 diabetic diagnosed in 1946, and I was within less than 10 years, I guess, dying of the consequences of this disease, including advanced kidney disease. Back in those days, we had no way of knowing what our blood sugars were at any given time. So I would have frequent blackouts from low blood sugars. I'd also have very high blood sugars. When I finally got married and brought up a family, my kids could find me unconscious at any time, because, as I said, we had no way of knowing what our blood sugars were. I was trained as an engineer.
What kind of engineer?
Industrial. Mm. Actually, even my educational background was corrupted by my ailments. I wanted to be a physicist, and I was taking graduate courses in mathematics at Columbia. And I didn't know that I was hypothyroid in addition to being diabetic. And I used to sleep through my classes. I used to miss classes because I didn't wake up in the morning. And I had a B-minus average in college. I couldn't remember things. There's a dementia associated with hypothyroidism. And there were only maybe two other physics majors in my class. And I decided that there was no way I could compete with them because I couldn't remember anything. So I decided to switch from physics to engineering, which required less intellectual ability. And when I applied to engineering school, they found this a very strange switcheroo, so they decided to test me to see what I really wanted to do. And they gave me what's called a professional option examination. And they found that if they looked at what I wanted to do, not what I was capable of doing, I should either be an architect or an opera singer.
An opera singer?
They were certainly right on the opera singer bit, because I am a basso. I didn't start taking singing lessons until I was in my 60s or 70s, and they had it right on back then.
Huh.
Anyway, I started engineering school, and the first semester got terrible grades, but then one of my doctors got the idea that I was hypothyroid, had me tested, and in those days, the test was to put you in a box and measure your respiration rate. and mine was the lowest anybody ever saw. And they put me on thyroid replacement, and I woke up and got straight A's and ended up in the Engineering Honor Society. If only I had known that when I was in college, I would have been a physicist.
Yeah, but you wouldn't have been. You wouldn't have done as much interesting stuff if you'd ended up as a physicist, I bet.
Right.
Well, you would have ended up doing a lot of mathematics in string theory or something, and you know, that would be probably it.
what probably would have happened is I wouldn't have ended up working as an engineer for a company that made medical equipment, and wouldn't have discovered blood sugar self-monitoring.
And you'd be dead.
And I'd be dead, right.
When do you think you would have died if you had not have figured out what you figured out?
Well, they in those days, type 1 diabetic was given 30 years from the time of diagnosis. So by 1976, I probably would have been dead.
So that's 40 years ago you should have been dead.
Yeah. So it's good that I ended up where I ended up.
So it was just by virtue of the fact that you were working at a medical instruments company and you were a type 1 diabetic, that you, so you were just an absolute edge case that just stumbled on this thing, basically.
Oh, well, this is what happened. There was an ad in a journal. I don't know if this journal still exists. It was called Lab World. And it was the trade journal for our company because we sold clinical laboratory equipment. And in fact, it was my job to develop this equipment. In fact, some of the equipment I developed way back, I don't know, 40, 50 years ago, I guess 50 years ago, is still being marketed. One of the products is called SETI Stain, which is used to stain urine for examination under the microscope. Another one is called the Redocrit microhematocrit centrifuge. And that was sort of a breakthrough in the field of measuring the hematocrit, which is the percentage of red cells in the blood. It made it possible to do it in a doctor's office very easily. And it's very interesting. I ended up at Einstein, at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine, working in the peripheral vascular disease clinic. That was sort of a fluky sort of situation, how I ended up doing that. But my chief was the world's authority on the diabetic foot. And when he retired from clinical practice, from private practice, he gave me his centrifuge, which was the one that I had developed.
Oh, wow.
And that I have a patent on the centrifuge tube that it uses, called the Redocrit tube.
So you figured out then about testing your blood glucose, and I've read your story a bunch of times. So you figured this out. You started to stabilize it a bit, but you didn't realize how important stabilizing it was. And then you later then really got into it and really figured out how to stabilize your blood sugar, and it made a major impact on your life.
Right. And then initially, I just wanted to avoid the hypoglycemia because when my blood sugar was low, I would take it out on anybody who was around me. It's very interesting that just today, my wife walked in. We share a patient. She's a psychiatrist. I'm his diabetologist. He's a type 1 diabetic. I've been treating him a long time. And she told me how nice he was to her on the phone. He says, "I love you." And she reminded me that sometimes he's not so nice to her, and she has to remind him to check his blood sugar.
Hmm.
Now, back when I couldn't check blood sugars, I'm sure I was not nice to people when my blood sugar was low. I was intolerant of people. For example, I've told many people, I had a boss who, while he was very smart, was not as smart as I was. And that was fine if my blood sugar was okay. But if my blood sugar were low, I'd yell at him and make him point out to him what a dope he was.
Right.
And
he might have been, but you just shouldn't have told him.
He ended up becoming president of a major medical company, but I was calling him a dope.
Right.
So it's no, you know, having a low blood sugar is not a good way to get along with people.
Yeah.
Knowing that I had advanced kidney disease and other problems, actually it was my father who thought that maybe getting exercise on a regular basis would stop or prevent the complications of diabetes.
Where did he think of that?
Many other people thought that.
Yeah, I mean, you didn't know that back then. Where did he come up with that?
My doctor had a patient named Billy Talbert, who was a world-famous tennis player. And he was a type 1 diabetic. I ended up meeting him. He was once on display at a major department store, and I went up there to see what he looked like, and he was almost blind, but he was in his 40s or 50s by then. So I thought my father's suggestion was reasonable,
right.
And but it wasn't correct. Exercise is good for anyone, but it's not going to prevent the complications of diabetes. At his suggestion, I ordered a literature search at the local medical library. Cost $75, and they pass it on to the Library of Congress, where a search takes a few weeks, and you get the results by mail. And there were no computers in those days. And lo and behold, there was one thing that they came up with. Exercise did not prevent complications of diabetes. They did point out that it lowered serum triglyceride. We didn't have HDL in those days, so we didn't know that in those days, but we knew about triglyceride. But they came up with the fact that in animals, if you normalized blood sugar, you prevented and even reversed the complications of diabetes.
Right.
And one complication that was very obviously reversible was kidney disease, diabetic kidney disease.
Which you had.
Which I had. And I therefore set about being more aggressive at attempting to normalize my blood sugars. And one thing that became rapidly apparent as I did little experiments on myself was that with the high carbohydrate diet that was being recommended for diabetics and is still being recommended for diabetics, there was no way I could control my blood sugars.
So you went into this with no opinion. You were just like, what the hell am I going to do? And
yeah.
After just testing stuff, you found out in the end that it was carbohydrates.
Right.
How long did it take you to reach that conclusion?
Well, as soon as I started doing serious experiments, it became apparent. And I came up with what I called the laws of small numbers. Actually, I initially called it the law of small numbers, which was that if you had small amounts of carbohydrate and small doses of insulin, in other words, if you behaved like you were a physiologic human pancreas, making tiny amounts of insulin on an as-needed basis, you would be doing something much more physiologic, whereas the American Diabetes Association was recommending mega doses of insulin to cover the mega doses of carbohydrate that they were recommending. And I could not make that work. Whereas if I dealt with tiny amounts of insulin and tiny amounts of carbohydrate, I could keep my blood sugar essentially normal.
But the American Diabetes Association is starting to come around to your view, are they not?
Yes and no. In November of 2012, they did using the word mega again, they did a mega analysis of the literature. They looked at many studies that were made upon diabetics insofar as the effects of diet. And they came to the conclusion that the only diet that both helped blood sugar and helped cardiac risk factors, there have always been interest in cardiac risk factors like LDL and HDL and things like that. The only thing that was good for both those factors, and namely blood sugar and cardiac risk factors, was a low carbohydrate diet. But of course, we cannot recommend that because we don't know the long-term effects.
Yeah, no, you know, because...
Now, of course, the long-term effects were known because for the bulk of human history, dietary carbohydrate, certainly rapid-acting dietary carbohydrate, was not available.
Right.
And everyone knew that. But there was one fact that they neglected to mention that was pointed out to me about 6 months ago by a very well-known researcher in the field of diabetes who's a type 1 diabetic himself. And he said, you totally missed the point that the bulk of the income of the American Diabetes Association is through their through the advertising in their journals. And if they were to advocate low-carbohydrate diets, the bulk of the products that they advertise would no longer be used or would be used only sparsely. In other words, a low-carbohydrate diet would...
There's nobody to fund it. Yeah,
...would
I mean,
be a very good substitute for many of the medications that the ADA is making money off of through their advertising.
In one of your transcripts, it made me very sad to see that you're talking in front of a group of doctors and explaining this stuff, and one of the doctors raises his hand and says, who's going to pay for this? And
that was the wisest question that was ever asked. Most of the questions that are asked are stupid when they're criticizing what I'm doing. But this was actually a diabetes educator who asked the question, and it was a good question. Who's going to pay for sitting down with diabetic patients and teaching them how to do all the things I advocate in my books? And that's a good question. Whoever pays for it, it's a lot cheaper than paying for treating the long-term complications of the disease. The amputations, the kidney transplants, the work on diabetic eyes, et cetera, et cetera.
To me, after reading your stuff, I almost don't really view diabetes as a condition. I view diabetes as just a catch-all for bad health. It just means you're unhealthy.
Yes, the effects of high blood sugar work across the board to affect every tissue of the body.
Right. And so this is actually one of the things I wanted to ask you. So I did an interview with Dr. Thomas Seyfried, who is at Boston College, and he's been looking a lot into what Otto Warburg did, who won a Nobel Prize in the 30s, who did a lot of extra research into the topic of whether cancer is actually a metabolic condition caused by, essentially, I guess, caused by high blood sugar. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I happen to have published a paper jointly with the immunology department of the Albert Einstein College of Medicine, where they presented it at an annual meeting of the Association of Allergy and Immunology. And their abstract, you know, like three paragraphs, got published amongst 1,500 other abstracts in the annual meeting journal. So I had discovered that in those days, when this was published, about 19% of diabetics had an immune deficiency disorder called CVID, common variable immune deficiency. And since that publication, my further studies have shown that 25% of my patients, of new patients when they walk in here, have this disorder. Now, the what happened was when I initially saw that about 19% of my patients had it, I called my friends at the immunology department. They send some fellows over to look at my data or look in my charts, and they tallied up 19% of my patients, of my new patients, had this disorder. And then once, and that was only when I was testing people who on an initial interview complained of sinusitis, chronic sinusitis. And then I, as soon as I saw their data, I immediately switched over to testing every new patient, and we ended up with 25% of them having this immune deficiency disorder. Now, if you were to do a literature search on CVID, common variable immune deficiency, you'll find that it predisposes very strongly to malignancies, most commonly bloodborne malignancies like leukemia and lymphoma, but also to malignancies in general. So
now you're scaring me, because I have sinusitis, and my father died of pancreatic cancer and was pre-diabetic. Is this treatable?
Well, yes, it is. It's treatable with intravenous gamma globulin, which replaces the missing globulins that protect you from cancers and from infections. Now, it's unfortunate that we had to publish in the annual meeting bulletin of a journal that is not read by diabetologists or internists. So it's still a secret, even though we published it. And the numbers are greater than we actually published. It turns out to be more like 25%, which is a very high percentage of diabetics. I'm constantly running into problems that people are experiencing because they have CVID. And I try to get this published in diabetes journals, and I couldn't get it published.
Well, you're a black sheep, so.
Yes, well, you're right. You hit it right on the nose. I'm the enemy because.
Otherwise, also known as the low carb. You're the low carb Taliban, is what some people call you, which I thought was hilarious.
that's right. People who are making money off of diabetes hate anybody who advocates normal blood sugars and who shows how normal blood sugars can be achieved. There are all kinds of things that I've discovered that I can't get published. For example, years ago, I discovered that virtually 100% of diabetics have psoriasis. And I tried to publish this in the research journal of the Psoriasis Association, and they told me, well, they're not interested in diabetes, they're just interested in psoriasis. And the editor of the diabetes journal said, we're just interested in diabetes, we're not interested in psoriasis.
Right. Yeah, I know how that works. We have the same thing amazing. That goes on in tech as well.
The kind of nonsense that one runs into. There are all kinds of things that I've stumbled on that are just not publishable because the authorities are not interested in it. And then there's the fact that I'm considered the enemy by the publishers associated with the American Diabetes Association, so they won't accept anything I submit.
Have you been publishing all of this stuff? I mean, for example, because you're 80 now, I think, aren't you?
Yeah, well, I'll be 80 in June.
So
in 3 months.
Yeah, well, you know, happy early birthday, and congratulations on being one of the longest lived type 1 diabetics. Have you written all of this down, of all of this stuff that you think needs to be researched?
Well, you're saying needs to be researched, it needs to be published.
Right.
And I have these monthly teleconferences, free teleconferences, where in addition to answering questions that listeners submit, I try every month to have extra subjects that no one asks about that I think are important. And that's how I leak out these interesting tidbits that are more than tidbits. They're very important.
Right.
And have been turned down by the medical establishment.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, you know, that's...
Where did I publish that 25% of diabetics are immune have this immune deficiency and are therefore susceptible to cancer? It's where I just told you in this obscure summary publication of allergy and immunology.
I mean, because the kind of thing that would be useful is like a one page, like, here's the stuff that needs to be looked at if I get hit by a bus. Because I think...
Very good point.
I think you're seeing a lot of things that the rest of the world isn't.
That the Journal of the American Medical Association has a forthcoming issue on diabetes, and I spoke to one of their editors a couple of weeks ago and said, hey, look, I've had this disease longer than almost anyone who's alive, and you should be interested in me. I've discovered a lot of things that no one knows about, and you should be writing up my observations. And I forgot what her reasons were, but they weren't interested.
Yeah. Now, well, Jimmy Moore's interested, and I'm interested, so that's two of us.
Well, just this week, the journal Lancet, the British journal, had a photo on the cover of an 85-year-old man who's in very good health because he exercises every day and does a few other things that are akin to my recommendations. And I asked my associate, Samantha, who works in my office, to contact one of the editors of Lancet, one of the USA editors of Lancet, and maybe I can talk them on doing the same kind of story they did on this non-diabetic fellow, to do it on me, so that I could disclose the tricks that I use and some of the things that I've learned that are important to preventing and treating diabetes. Whether they're going to be interested or not, I don't know.
Yeah, I think you already know the answer.
I don't know for sure, because you never can tell, because sometimes you run into a friendly editor, you never know.
I guess so. Let me ask you some. I've got a lot of questions I've prepared that I want to ask you, so I want to jump into those. Well, I was a little bit sad the other day. I emailed out to my an email list talking a little bit about diabetes and how I thought a lot of the treatments were wrong. And a girl that had been on my list for several years wrote back, and turns out that she's in a nursing home as a type 1 diabetic and is on intravenous something or other and is basically in a really bad state. And I asked her about carbohydrates, and it turns out that she's been doing what the ADA says and eating a lot of carbohydrates. We talked about it back and forth, and she then said she has a mitochondrial disease, and it's not just strict type 1 diabetic. But it seemed like she was just following what she was told to do, and that it had really driven her down. She's 26 years old, living in a nursing home. I'm curious as to your thoughts on that and how reversible the sort of problems that she might have might be.
Well, you know, I hear these stories and I get depressed right away and tears come to my eyes, and it all this is so avoidable, and the people who run the show don't care, which is very sad. I have many patients who come here already loaded with complications. In fact, the physical exam I do, which is very detailed, elicits, let's say, an average of 20 different complications in every new patient whom I test, no matter how long they've been diabetic. Because even the ones who are newly discovered have actually had diabetes for a lot longer than they realize. Huh. And I find all these complications, and it's unfortunate. On the fortunate side, if they've only been diabetic a short time, the bulk of the complications we find are reversible. And I'll give you examples. I test every new patient for diplopia, which is double vision. It's very easy to test for, even though other doctors don't do it, and even ophthalmologists don't do it, because you have to take some time. It takes about 5 minutes to do it. You have to put a red filter over one eye and have them look through both the red filter and no filter, and you shine a little light and move it around. And let's say that a new patient has double vision in 7 out of 9 directions of gaze. Well, what I find is if we keep their blood sugar absolutely normal and then have them come back in 2 years and test them again, they might only have double vision in, let's say, 5 directions of gaze. Another 2 years, they might only have double vision in 3 directions of gaze, and so on. Huh. And eventually, they don't have double vision anymore. And I look at their feet, and let's say, originally at the first visit, they had almost totally dry skin on their feet, and no hair on their feet, or maybe 2 hairs on their big toe. And then they come back in a few years, and I find that the plantar surface, the bottoms of their feet, is now moist, where it wasn't moist before. And now they have 6 hairs on their big toes, and right. So on. And you go down the list of things that I find, And if you really achieve normal blood sugars, and many of them do, you start seeing reversals of these early complications. Another thing that I looked at that is very important and is quantitative is what's called cardiac autonomic neuropathy. I look at their, I do an EKG while they're inhaling and exhaling, deep breathing it's called, and I look at their heart rate on inspiration and their heart rate on expiration. It's called the RR interval study, which is known to most researchers in diabetes, but it's something the clinicians never bother to measure. But I've been measuring it in all my new patients and older patients since I've been in practice. And this, as a matter of fact, the literature says that when you have a grossly abnormal RR study, on average, you only have 5 years to live. And I've seen RR studies get better in patients who normalize their blood sugars and get worse in people who don't bother to control the carbohydrate intake and therefore don't have normal blood sugars. So it's something that's very important, easy to measure, and no one else is doing it. No one else is measuring it. It also helps me to predict in advance whether they have gastroparesis, which is paralysis of stomach emptying that's very common amongst diabetics and affects whether or not you're going to have an easy time controlling blood sugars. Again, doctors don't test for it, and they're not interested in it. And so on and on and on, ad infinitum. There's so many of these studies that I do and things that I look at that no one is interested in except me. And it's sad.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, no, it's this stuff's brutal. My father died a year and a half ago of pancreatic cancer, which we talked about earlier, and he was pre-diabetic, and you know, you've got me wondering if he'd have stabilized his blood sugar. Firstly, could that have prevented it? Because obviously, the pancreas is pretty key when it comes to diabetes. Or would he have needed this CVID intravenous gamma globulin treatment?
Yeah, it would not have controlling his blood sugars would not have prevented the pancreatic cancer, but if he were discovered to have CVID, let's say 10 years ago, and if he were given intravenous gamma globulin, that probably could have prevented the pancreatic cancer. But there's a catch. Unless you are symptomatic of something important, insurance is not going to pay for the IV gamma globulin in this country. Plain and simple. Uh-huh. Now, there are all kinds of interesting stories I could tell you about this. For example, how did I stumble on CVID? Well, I stumbled on it about 15 or 16 years ago when I tested myself because I had chronic sinusitis since childhood that was getting progressively worse and was started when I was a little kid when it only happened in the winter and I'd have to stay home from school. By the way, I became an expert on all of the soap operas that used to play during the day when I was a kid. I knew all the actors, I knew all the sponsors. For example, I knew Oxydol's own Ma Perkins. Now, no one alive today even knows what Oxydol was. It was a laundry soap that doesn't exist anymore. It came in an orange box with blue stripes on it. And I know who the author of Stella Dallas was. Stella Dallas was another soap opera. Olive Higgins Prouty. Stella Dallas was based upon the great novel by Olive Higgins Prouty. And there's all this other nonsense in the way of trivia that I know about because I was home most of the time when I was a little kid and couldn't go to school.
Because of your allergies.
Because it wasn't allergies. It was I had immune deficiency, and therefore I had colds. I was sick and had sore throats and coughs and all that kind of stuff.
And so that all went away when you did the Glamour
and Globular. And what happened, it got worse and worse as I got older. And shortly after I moved my office to my home, where I have a new wing for my office, I had to have a steamer, a vaporizer, on my table in front of me all winter long, inhaling steam because I was so sick. And then it got so bad that I even had it in the summer. By that time, I realized I had an immune deficiency, so I tested for it. And since I knew that people with immune deficiencies also had malignancies, I also made a blood smear, which nowadays doctors don't know how to make. But I knew how to make blood smears because I worked for a company that sold the slides and the cover glasses that were used in the smears.
This damn engineer that didn't figure all this stuff out.
So I made hundreds of slides because of various problems that we had. We had what were called, we had some of the slides, some of the glass that we got from Dow Corning had what were called Newton's rings when you put the cover slips on them. And we were trying to develop Newton ring-free glass. And so I was making blood smears to see what would happen to the smears when you got rid of the Newton's rings. And so I became an expert at making blood smears. So I made my own blood smear, submitted it to the lab, and they tell me not only did I have CVID, but I also had lymphoma.
Oh, wow. So you picked up your own cancer that you didn't even
so
know about.
Yeah, I diagnosed it myself. And fortunately, I had been using as a consultant for my own patients, people who had AIDS and other immune deficient disorders, I had been using the top immunologist in the country, so I used him to treat myself. And I was one of the first people in the country to get an antibody to lymphoma called Rituxan.
How early stage did you catch it?
We caught it very early, and I was lucky. Now, lymphoma, as of today, lymphoma doesn't go totally away. Usually it returns and causes enlarged lymph nodes within 5 years. But because I was also getting gamma globulin to treat my immune deficiency, by the way, the immune deficiency, in addition to causing severe sinusitis, caused severe diarrhea because I had low immunoglobulin A, which is the immunoglobulin of mucous membranes, which are not only in the nasal passages, but they're also in the intestines. So I had both diarrhea and sinusitis.
Huh.
And
you must have been a real party to be around.
I'm very fortunate in that here we are, I don't know, close to 20 years later, probably about 17 years after my treatment. I only have, I think it's 11% malignant lymphocytes, and it's steady at that level. They're not increasing so far. We have to check them with PET scans periodically. So I've been lucky, and it's probably because I get this immunoglobulin every 3 weeks.
How much does it cost?
It costs, my insurance, I see bills between $3,000 and $7,000 a treatment. Why there's such a range of billing, I don't know. But I don't have to pay for it.
That's expensive.
So I'm lucky. Now, it happens that the guidelines for Medicare include the fact that it must pay for this particular condition. I'm very lucky. And it's by an act of Congress. And how someone managed to pull those strings is beyond me, but probably there is a congressman somewhere whose family has CVID, and he managed to save my life or keep me going. Now, it's interesting that I have a sister who started getting a strange disease, and I suggested that she be tested. In fact, I sent her an order form for getting the same blood tests that I used on myself, and it turned out that she has the same immunodeficiency that I have, and with a lot of effort, she's been able to get it because she has a strange kind of malignancy that leaves her with holes in her skin all over her body. And they had no treatment for it that was working except plastic surgery filling in the holes. And since she's been getting amoglobulin, the holes are filling in automatically. So
it's essentially almost a miracle cure.
Her dermatologist just wrote a paper about her because this disease is so rare. And she's lucky that she's able to that Medicare is willing to pay for it.
We're almost out of time. I want to ask you a question on stress. And I've read this in your books. You talk about that, and I've tested this myself, that stress does not raise your blood glucose. But you say sometimes that it does and sometimes that it doesn't. And so I'm curious as to where you stand on that.
Okay. When I was 12 years old, no, I was 13. No one could understand why I was getting over 200 units of insulin a day, which is about 20 times what a kid my size makes. And it was because I was on this high carbohydrate diet. I was living on almost only carbohydrate. Because they thought that would prevent heart disease. They still have that myth.
Yeah.
Even though they're killing people right and left. And they sent me to the Joslin Clinic, which then was run by Elliot P. Joslin, who was a lot more of a believer in normal blood sugars than the current people in Boston seem to be. And I attended lectures, which were given for adults, but I went to the lectures, and I only remember one thing that he taught. He said, never run for a bus unless you're going to run a mile. Never run a block for a bus. If you're going to run for a bus, run a mile. And his point was that you're going to make counter-regulatory hormones called stress hormones, that are going to raise your blood sugar. And you won't get enough exercise running a block to bring the blood sugar down. Now, I have plenty of patients whom, when they speak in public, let's say they're teachers or they may be performers or singers, their blood sugars go up. I even have kids who, when they have an important soccer game, their blood sugars go up. So stress does raise blood sugar if you're a diabetic.
So is that for a T1 diabetic?
It could be for any diabetic. Exercise will not necessarily raise blood sugar. In fact, it might lower blood sugar if it is very strenuous and concentrated. So when I go to the gym, I do such intensive exercise, some people call it the slow burn, that I have to check my blood sugar after every two exercises, and I usually will drop by 10 every two exercises, 10 milligrams per deciliter. And I have to be drinking liquid glucose every two exercises, or I won't be able to do a decent workout. So certain kinds of stress, physical stress, that is exercise, if concentrated, can lower blood sugar dramatically. And other kinds of exercise, like getting into a fight with your spouse or public speaking or whatnot, can raise your blood sugar if you're a diabetic.
I tested, I got stressed for one day, and I just because of some stuff that happened, and then I tested meditating. And I tested before and after meditating, and I found no change in blood sugar. However, emotionally, I was much better after I meditated.
Well, you're not a diabetic.
Right.
Now, you do have a father with a bad history, and it might be wise to look at your hemoglobin A1C, which is a test of your average blood sugar for the past 3 months.
5.5.
Okay, well, unfortunately, that's elevated. That's an average blood sugar of about 120.
Right.
And normal is around 83.
Right.
So you're about 50% above normal. And I actually...
Go on, say. You want to diagnose me as diabetic on this call, don't you?
See, I tend to be much more aggressive.
Right, I know.
I would say, you know, if a typical situation, I have a patient who's diabetic. He's 16 years old. And we just tested his mother, and she's 5.6.
Hmm.
So she's got a higher A1C than he because he's being treated. And he has two siblings, and they're both around 5.3. And something has to be done for all of them.
Right.
They should all be on low-carbohydrate diets. They should all be exercising. And if their A1Cs don't come down to, let's say, 4.2 to 4.6, they should have some mild oral agents that are benign. In fact, one of the oral agents, metformin, is actually now being used experimentally to fight cancer because they discovered by accident that it fights cancer.
No, I'm well aware of this and working to get my A1C down. I've got I bought it from one of your team that sells on the internet the A1C home test kit, and so tracking that every month.
I don't know how accurate it is. I would suggest that you I made him remove it from the web page that he developed for my teleconferences because I didn't get very good results with it.
I tested the evening before and the evening after a lab test, and my A1C kit gave me a 5.7 and a 5.8, and then the lab was 5.5. So I thought that was okay.
Okay, well, you know, it was a little on the high side. You know, I'd feel safer going to the lab, what can I say?
Yeah.
A difference of 3 is 12 on the average blood sugar.
And so for those listening to this, what we're discussing here is A1C, it's an average blood glucose level over a three-month period. It's what you're essentially your trailing average. It may turn out to be the single most important data point to evaluate your health. It's not talked about. It's sort of known. My father, who died of pancreatic cancer and had, they said he had an insulin sensitivity. They never bothered testing his A1C. They only tested his fasting blood glucose, which is unreliable. So you want to check your A1C, and I would follow what our friend here, the low-carb Taliban, says. You want it to be 4.2 and 4.6, and you can hear I'm on this call. I'm potentially getting diagnosed myself with either pre-diabetes or diabetes, and it's right, and its numbers are really important.
There's interestingly, in addition to the unfortunate guidelines for the treatment of diabetes, where they seek high blood sugars and give people a lot of carbohydrate, there are all kinds of sleazy situations going on in the marketing of products. Something recently came about, probably when Medicare started requiring that Medicare pay for blood sugar equipment going to the lowest bidder. So we're now in a situation that's approaching what exists in New Zealand. New Zealand, a couple of years ago, they decided that blood sugar strips for diabetics had to be the lowest cost they could acquire. So they started buying the strips from Korea and Thailand, and the strips were totally inaccurate. So diabetics cannot get accurate blood sugars in New Zealand.
Huh.
They have a national health service that pays you get them for free, but they're inaccurate. They're grossly inaccurate. In fact, they're worthless.
Ouchie.
And we're heading that way in the USA, where now the companies that review claims for insurers and pharmacies act as middlemen, and they get paid a certain amount from Medicare, and they'll go out and buy the cheapest they can find, even if it's inaccurate, and force the Medicare recipients to take products that are inaccurate.
Huh.
And we're trying to battle this for our patients. There are little games that we play. The people who manage the payments are giving all kinds of excuses for turning down patients' claims for accurate strips. And they also turn down the number of strips that a patient wants.
These silly little strips that are almost, hardly cost anything.
Well, they can cost up to a dollar. Let's say they typically may cost about 75 cents. But some of these insurance managers are not allowing a type 2 diabetic to get more than 3 strips a week, for example.
3 strips. And so people know, like, you, if you're testing a lot, you may want to be testing your blood sugar, 5 or 6 times a day.
Because people with CVID who get gamma globulin get a partial beta cell recovery, again, something I haven't published, which the journals rejected. They can get hypoglycemia at random. So I have to check my blood sugar every hour. So I use a huge number of strips.
Huh.
And the only way I'm able to get them is because I get the strip manufacturers to give me extra strips to give away to new patients, and I keep some of them for myself. Because Medicare would never give me enough strips, I'd be in big trouble with the current system.
Huh.
So there are all kinds of sleazy programs going on, and I won't go into all the details, but
we've got a lot of stuff backwards. I understand that in a lot of depth, and I don't want to take more of your time. I do want to ask one last quick question, and then we should wrap up because I don't want to over. I know you're a busy guy. What was your last A1C score?
It was 5.1, which was a lot higher than I would like, and it relates to this CVID, the fact that I have to play it on the safe side. Overnight, I set an alarm to wake me every 3 hours. I couldn't possibly do it every hour. And I have to be a little on the high side in case I get hit at random in the middle of the night.
So you're dealing with a whole lot of mess, and yours is 5.1, and I've just started learning about this in the last month and a half, and mine's 5.5. So, and you're almost 80, and I'm 41.
Yeah, and the cards are stacked up against me because of the effects of the gamma globulin. Hmm. I once walked out of the infusion center, walked into the glass doors at the exit, fell down unconscious, woke up in an emergency van parked in the driveway there, and there's my immunologist in his white coat with a big smile on his face. And I said, "What happened?" So he tells me what happened, and he said, "Your blood sugar was 30 or less," and he says, "This happens to all my type 1 diabetics." Huh. I said, "So what do you do about it?" He said, "Well, you're the expert. You tell me."
Yeah.
And the only answer I could think of was very frequent blood sugar testing. And I have any number of other diabetics, patients of mine who are getting gamma globulin, who have to do the frequent blood sugar testing, or they're in trouble.
Yeah, amazing stuff. Well, thank you for the work that you've been doing, and I know it is, you know as well, your work is going to get recognized by the mainstream in time. It's just going to take a little bit of time to win them over.
Well, will it happen in my lifetime?
I hope it will.
Time's going fast.
Yeah, but you keep finding all these things that keep you going, so you're probably going to live to be about 120.
Well, I'm on the 65th reunion committee. The 60th reunion committee of my college class. And I wanted a list of names. You know, who should we be calling in our class to let them know about the reunion? Give us a list of names. So what's the first list they send us? A necropsy list.
What's that?
A list of our dead classmates.
Right.
It was a long list.
Yeah.
And I protested the name. I said, "Why don't you change it to memorial list?"
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm pretty close to the necropsy list.
Well, I think I have a feeling you're going to hang on for rather a while, given what you're doing. But anyway, Dr. Bernstein, thank you very much for the interview. Thank you for all of your work. I think you know you've done historic work, and it's important stuff, and thank you.
Adrian, good talking to you. There's a famous seaside place called Blackpool, what's noted for fresh air and fun. And Mr. and Mrs. Ramsbottom went there with young Albert, their son. A grand little lad was young Albert, all dressed in his best, quite a swell, with a stick with a horse's head handle, the finest what Woolworths would sell. They didn't think much to the ocean, the waves there was fiddling and small. There was no wrecks and nobody drowned. In fact, nothing to laugh at all. So seeking for further amusement, they paid and went into the zoo, where there's lions and tigers and camels and old ale and sandwiches too. There was one great big lion named Wallace, whose nose was all covered with scars. He lay in a somnolent posture, with the side of his face to the bars. Now Albert had heard about lions, how they was ferocious and wild. To see Wallace lion so peaceful, well, it didn't seem right to the child. So straightway the brave little fella not showing a morsel of fear, took his stick with the horse's head handle and shoved it in Wallace's ear. And it goes on like that.
Was that from memory or you were reading it?
By memory.
Because I looked at it online and was following along, and you got almost every single word exactly right.
Yeah, that's by memory. I learned when I was a commuter, I recorded it and played it back in my car, you know, when we had cassette tapes, so that I'd be able to recite it for my kids.